Our speaker is Professor James Stator, Professor of the and Director of the Hawaii Research Center for Future Studies. And he is going to speak to us today. We're very fortunate to have him here. Your alternative is to go over to UH to hear him. He's going to speak to us today at the Unholy Trinity Plus One on governing the end of the world as we know it. So with that, let me introduce Jim, and he'll explain to us this end of the world part, and it's kind of scary, but I guess here we are. So, Jim, please.
You want to? Okay, normally I don't need a mic. I'm so loud, people would prefer not to hear me anyway, so clearly, but I understand it's being recorded, so I'll speak into the microphone. Yes, the title is exactly as described. The Unholy Trinity Plus One, subtitle on governing the end of the world as we knew it. Now, those of you who know me, and I've been around here as long as many of the people in this room, know that I'm a techno-optimist. I have always made a reputation as being very optimistic about the future. And assuming that if people were told of dangers and opportunities lying ahead, that people would respond to it. Perhaps you recall the Hawaii 2000 exercises that began in 1969, 1970, in which citizens of the state, I still think it was the most expansive and intensive experience of a citizen group looking ahead that's ever existed anywhere on the face of the earth. Almost everyone in Hawaii was involved in it in one way or another. And we raised many issues then that have now come to be problems. I had the opportunity when the actual year 2000 came around, 30 years after the conference, to look over what we said, our problems and opportunities, what they were likely to be, and the kind of a future we wanted. And we did a pretty good job of identifying the problems and opportunities of the present. But we did, obviously, a very, very, very poor job in getting the citizens of this state to have the kind of future that they said in 1970 they wanted for the year 2000. In fact, we had a worst-case scenario done by Bob Schmidt, the state statistician, in which he took all of the bad things that were happening in 1970 and projected them into the future. And we all said, oh, that's awful. We don't want that. Well, in 2000, we went back and looked at those same statistics. We had gotten worse on every one of them than our projections had indicated. So I have the luxury of saying, hey, we were right, and also the dismal feeling of saying, yeah, we were right, but we were politically ineffective in getting citizens to deal with it. And so I am here to say that a lot of things that we worried about, identified, I think correctly, 30 or so years ago, 40 years now, we have are now here. They still will get worse. And that's the part that I want to talk about. So many of you have had a nice lunch, might just want to put your heads down on the table and go to sleep for a while. Or any of you who don't want to hear some doom and gloom, you might want to leave because there's going to be some doom and gloom. But what I want to point out is that the end of the world as we knew it also provides a wonderful opportunity for a kind of a future that many people have said and still say that they want. So that's the main thing I want you to think about as you hear me talk, that while a kind of a world that was pretty good for most of us, may be coming to an end, I believe that it provides an opportunity for us to have a future Hawaii that is quite different from the present and the immediate past, and that is what many people say is their preferred future. As the year 2000 came around, that was a very good year for futurists. The only year that has been equally good was 1984. these two dates sort of mean the future, still mean the future. It's weird to many people. But as the year 2000 came around, I had an opportunity of going to many groups like this and presenting them with four alternative futures, because a futurist can't predict the future, but rather I can show you that there are some general large opportunities and possibilities. So I would divide people into four futures and ask them to tell me which one they like better. And the one that most people said they liked was not the one that was basically the present continued, but was one in which values that had been lost, they felt, over the past 100 years or so, were being recaptured. Now, Bud Smizer, whom many of you may recall, was editor of the Honolulu Star Bulletin. When he retired from that position, he got a job at the East-West Center for a number of years and put out a Future of Hawaii publication in which, in fact, he used my four alternative futures but put his content and labels on them. And the one that I just described, that I said many people indicated they wanted in the year 2000, Smizer labeled as Hawaii as a backwater. Hawaii as a backwater. Well, I've noticed recently that more and more people are saying they'd sort of like that if some of the things that characterized Hawaii when it was sort of a backwater were to come again. And in fact, there was an article in the Star in the Advertiser a few months ago written by DeGray Vanderbilt on Molokai. You might have read it, but let me just read a brief section of what he says. Molokai's sustainable vision still remains active with dedicated community support as residents watch the unrelenting exploitation throughout the state of working families, the environment, and the aloha spirit by those who already have enough. In the 1950s and 1960s, Hawaii was filled with sustainable communities. No one had much money, but most led a rich lifestyle. Back then, a family could afford a decent house and lot, even though wages were low. Things were in balance, but no more. Anger and resentment continue to swell today as our state tumbles out of balance as it moves more and more towards a two-class society. But Molokai's tight community has refused to go down that road. On Molokai, things have remained relatively in balance compared with the rest of the state. Molokai is the last island still under control of the local population. That's why it remains the friendly island. It is this control factor that keeps people smiling and allows residents to continue believing things will be done right on Molokai so that our island's unique local lifestyle is sustained for future generations to enjoy. Now, I have no idea whether that's an accurate statement of Molokai. I have no idea whether it's a majority view, but I'll tell you, it is a view that I hear many, many, many people making when I ask them what kind of a future would they like Hawaii to be. Even people most actively involved in making that future impossible say that that's nonetheless for themselves what they would prefer. Well, I'm here to say that I believe we can have such a future. I think that a number of things are happening that will make it possible to have the kind of a future that I just heard described. But isn't Hawaii just going to continue growing and growing forever with more tourists, more development, more destruction of old habitat and cultures and lifestyles? Come on in, Tom. Good to see you. I'm happy to say, Larry, that you did a great job in your email, because I'd say one-fourth of the audience are people that are future students that got that email notice. Or maybe it was the free lunch. Or not free, but at least lunch. Not a free lunch that attracted them here. So this future of continued growth certainly remains the dominant one, the one we read about in the newspaper all the time, the one which, when it is lost, the leaders of the state get together and say, how do we keep growing again? We simply must have more and more and more, and any time there's a stability or a decline, that's viewed as a loss. But so that's the official future, without a shadow of a doubt. But I want to call your attention to another possibility. And I call it, in a twist on Smizer's negative view, Hawaii as the best little backwater on the planet. So that's what I want to talk about now. And it will result from, it could result from what I call the unholy trinity plus one. Now, I've been sharing this view with people like yourselves, people who care about Hawaii, who work with people in Hawaii who already are in need in some ways and also care about the future of this place, because I believe it is people like you in communities like the Kokua Council, like churches, like labor unions, other groups like this, who might be able to take the events that I'm describing and make them into a great possibility, a positive possibility. So, first, what is this unholy trinity I'm talking about? Well, you're all Christians, or many of you are, at least I am speaking in an edifice dedicated to that faith, which talks about the Trinity, God in three persons, but still one God, a great mystery. Try to explain it, and you certainly will commit a heresy. It's very difficult to get the story right. And so most people focus on one of the three persons of the Trinity more than the other three. For example, at the present time, Jesus definitely gets top billing. Hear a lot about him. But there were times, especially when the United States was founded, when most Christians talked about God the Father, that is, God as creator of this world. And if America is a Christian nation, it was a particular type of Christianity of that time that focused on God as the great clockmaker, that the clock, the mechanism, could be understood through human reason. Or other folks at different times focus on the Holy Spirit. Roman Catholic Church especially likes the Holy Spirit because it allows them to change doctrine by saying, well, God told me to. And so you can constantly update the tradition and make it ever pertinent. They could make some more changes, but any of them. But I've chosen the term in order to combine three secular processes that are often considered separately. Someone noting one of the three and focusing on it is unlikely to pay appropriate or equal attention to the other two. Indeed, what I find is solutions to the one are often thought to exist in the other two. And yet, it isn't going to work that way, as I'll show you. All three are in crisis together and must be viewed together, along with something else, which is the plus one of my title. So I'm going to give you what may seem at first to be bad news, but as I said, my basic message is to tell you that a wonderful future that many of us want may result from these forces if we choose to make it so. Otherwise, I think we are facing the end of the world as we knew it. So the first person of the unholy trinity is the end of cheap and abundant oil, before any equivalent replacement takes over, the so-called peak oil issue. I'm sure everyone here has heard about it. If not, I hope you will please find out about it. More and more of us here, still not enough, are coming to realize how totally dependent Hawaii is on oil for everything we do. And yet, the era of cheap and abundant oil is over. Oil will become more and more scarce and more expensive from now on. Of course, it'll go up and down. The price will go up and down, but basically it's going to go up and up as the absolute supply goes down and down. While some of us know this, most of us are still either in ignorance of it or in denial of that fact. And every day the newspapers are full of more articles of denial, making statements in the headlines in the first couple of paragraphs that look as though it's a conspiracy. Oh, there's plenty of stuff. All we got to do is drill. I must say I happened to be on the mainland a couple of months ago, and suddenly Neil Abercrombie's face appeared in some news story in which he would say, "We got to drill for that oil. Go get that Gulf oil." I say, "What? What in the world are you talking about, Neil? That ain't going to solve anything. That'll simply make environmental problems in that part of the world worse. Give us just an extra sip, but basically just part of a policy to drain America dry, to make sure there's no oil left in the future for future generations. Doesn't sound like good policy. Now, many energy solutions exist in principle. Many exist in principle. But none that I'm aware of is ready to take over from oil. So I thought 30 years ago, when we first talked about these issues, many of you will remember, that people would use the time from then to now to develop the energy sources that would be able to take over from oil so that we could have a more or less smooth transition from then to now. And there was in the 70s, you'll recall, some genuine effort towards that end. But we allowed economic myths to kill those experiments. And so we are now far worse off, far less prepared to deal with those that energy transition than we had before. So I specifically worry about what I call the gap between the time we effectively run out of oil in terms of it being cheap enough and abundant enough that we're able to live our current lifestyle, and the time when these new alternatives do come online. And the question is, how long is that gap? Is it a couple of years? Is it a couple of decades? Is it a couple of centuries? Or will we somehow be able to prevent the gap by miracles that I'm unaware of? Now, this will certainly be a disaster for Hawaii if we don't take it seriously. Most obviously, our entire tourism industry has been based on and blessed or cursed by extremely cheap energy prices, oil prices, over the last 30 or so years. One of my things that I look at every once in a while is a ticket that I used to go from here to a conference of the World Future Studies Federation that was in Egypt in the 1970s. And that ticket is actually the same price, the same dollar price that I would pay for a ticket, not now, but let's say 6 months ago, to Egypt. That is to say, in spite of tremendous inflation since the 70s to now, the actual price of airplane tickets has dramatically fallen over the past 30 or so years. And we have been living in a fool's paradise, believing that that energy would continue to be cheap enough that we could base our economy on it. It worked well for a while, but I don't think it's going to work much longer. Our own travel, if it hasn't been impacted, probably will soon be impacted by that, by the price. And of course, almost all of our food and all of our material is brought in by oil. So I think we must learn to be as self-sufficient here in Hawaii as soon as possible in all of the fundamental areas upon which our living is based. Conservation we should be hysterical about conservation. We should be absolutely insisting that we are far more cautious in our burning of existing oil instead of trying to find more for people to burn even faster. We here, especially in Hawaii, where we have all sorts of potential energy systems out there, but none of them are able to quickly segue into the amount of flowing energy that we have through oil at the present time or until recently. One last point One of the key issues that folks may or may not understand can often be called net energy, the net energy problem. That is to say, it takes money and it takes time and it takes knowledge, but it also takes energy to create new energy. And so you have to get more energy out at the end than you put in the process. And so far, all, or at least almost all, effectively all of the alternative energy sources that we talk about now are not energy producing. They're energy losing. And we're hoping that at some point breakthroughs will come that will enable us to get more energy out than we're putting in. But so far, we're not, to my knowledge. All right, there's so much more to say on that, but that's one. Let's go to the second person of the Trinity. And that is all of the things that are called, that are under the environmental umbrella of climate change, of sea level rise, of new and renewed diseases, of environmental refugees. Does Kokua work with Micronesians, the Micronesian community? But those folks who are in the helping communities that are dealing with new immigrants know that while the Micronesians are not moving here because of the fact their islands are vanishing, their islands will be vanishing, and we will see more and more environmental refugees here in the state. And so we can learn from the experiences of those who are, in a sense, flooding here from places like Chuuk and elsewhere. So I believe that we knew about these issues long, long ago. I won't go through the whole story again, but we basically ignored the problems. And now it's too late to prevent environmental transformation, in my view. It'll take a lot of money, a lot of time, a lot of energy, a lot of intelligence, and a lot of luck to address these looming issues effectively. And again, I think we should start doing so now with extreme urgency. Much more to say on that issue, but if of the three, I think that's the one that is most well understood, though still certainly not effectively addressed, to my knowledge. So let me go to the third one. The collapse of the global capitalist economic system. Our global and local economy is built very largely on debt, not on productivity and not on hard work. Over the past 75 years, actually longer, but I'm going to focus on the past 75 years, we have faced a series, the nation and the world, has faced a series of economic crises that we have solved basically by inventing an ever-compounding debt instruments, a series of ever-compounding debt instruments, thus placing the day of reckoning farther and farther into the future of our children and grandchildren, rather than solving them by developing sustainable economic systems. Let me just illustrate by reminding you of events in your lives, going back to the Great Depression, which some of you may remember vividly. Others may remember at least as children. And some of you younger folks might have heard about as something crazy that your grandparents did. In order to put that in context, I think you have to consider that the U.S. is not actually a free market economy. It has been, at least for the last 75 years, a command economy, very much like communism. The economy is controlled from the top, from the federal government, by its taxing, purchasing, and debt policies. If you view the economy as a cake, let's say as a pound cake, big, heavy pound cake, the bulk of that cake is determined by federal government taxing, purchasing, and debt instruments. And up on top is this really tasty frosting. That's the free market part that we focus on and think that the whole cake is made of it. It isn't. There's a lot else in there that I won't talk about, but the key part is to understand the role that government plays. Now, most Americans are either, again, as I said, in ignorance or in total denial of that, or else I'm completely wrong, which is possible as well. Most of us believe that we are in a free market economy. And so, as a consequence, when the U.S. is faced with a crisis, we try to solve it by declaring war on something so that we can engage in definite financing to keep the economy growing. That's particularly important. It's un-American for us to allow the state to address and try to solve social environmental problems. But it's profoundly American for us to declare war on something and then, in a state of war, to engage in deficit funding. So if you look at the series of events that I'm going to call attention to, war, either literal or figurative, has played a major, if not the major, role in solving, that is to say, postponing the economic issues. Let's go back to the Depression, when times for about a decade were extremely bad. We had policies of the New Deal that many people thought were just one step away from socialism or communism. And those policies, while useful and necessary probably, in order to prevent communism, actually didn't solve the Depression. What solved the Depression, if anything, was the Second World War. Now, I'm not saying we caused the Second World War to solve the economic depression, but I'm not saying we didn't either, because we are aware of the role that war would play. Now, after the war, because of the Depression and the rationing and the fact that we were the only victorious nation in that war, there was a tremendous explosion of pent-up wealth and demand. But then, when recession started, we invented the Cold War Part One. It's important to understand there were two Cold Wars, one from 1950 to 1970s, and the other from 1980s to 1989, two different Cold Wars. In between, there was something else. And I'm not going to say that the only reason the Cold War occurred was to solve the economic crisis, but it was a way in which now the government could engage in deficit spending to solve the economic contradictions that the nation and the world was suffering at the time. And then there was this era of stagflation. You remember when you first heard the term, it simply didn't make sense to have both inflation and a stagnating economy. That was exacerbated, perhaps brought on, by the oil crises of the 1970s. Now, do you remember what we call those oil crises? We said the Arab oil crisis. Now, it's the Arab oil crisis because we were in detente with the Soviet Union. The Cold War was basically over, and we were getting along with the Soviet Union. We were going in space together, doing all sorts of wonderful things, exchanging scholars and ping pong and all sorts of wonderful things. And so we had to blame somebody, couldn't blame ourselves, so we blamed the Arabs for doing bad things to us. And you recall the tremendous inflation that resulted from that, and that's when oil prices really rose extremely dramatically. Well, how did we solve that? I won't say this is, again, the only reason, the only thing that did it, but that is the era in which consumer credit cards suddenly proliferated. I can remember in the 50s and 60s when I wanted a credit card to buy gasoline. There were so few things you could get credit cards for, but if you didn't have some kind of credit, we weren't going to be able to see the USA on our Chevrolet. So the oil companies came up with something that would allow us to buy gas and batteries and tires and oil. But that was about it. The only other credit cards we had to be paid off 100% at the end of the month. And then suddenly came ChargeX and other things like this, Visa, that allowed us now to buy and not pay off at the end of the month. And I have this very vivid experience. I had just come back from Japan. I was living in Virginia Tech with three children and an assistant professor salary. And therefore, I went from one Christmas to another in constant economic crisis. And here came a credit card that allowed me to put all my children's Christmas gifts on this card. And of course, I maxed it out. It was probably $200, something like that at the time. And the telephone call came. Dr. Dater, you have reached your credit limit. I know. I'm sorry, I'll pay it off. No. We don't want you to pay it off. We want to raise your limit. Oh, okay. And so every time the bill came due, raise the limit and just pay off a little bit to keep the system going. God forbid I should actually be able to pay it off, which neither I nor anyone else could do. And then few 10 or so years later, these cards just came flooding in, right? You would just throw them out as they would come in. And at the University of Hawaii, they were all over the place for students. Please get deeply into debt. Come on, do your thing. Keep the economy growing. Well, it kept the economy growing, but it simply put them and everyone else more deeply in debt. When that wasn't enough, and it's never enough, the voodoo solutions of Reaganomics and the renewed Cold War, part two, because that's basically what happens. We've got to get the economy growing again. Oh, there's the evil empire over there. Let's suddenly gear up and defeat that evil empire, even though it had no new renewed aims at us whatsoever. And it was during Reagan's time, from 80 to 83, because of these deficit spending policies, which require that we borrow money from people who had it since we didn't, that the United States within 3 years became the number one creditor nation to the number one debtor nation, where we still remain, every second getting deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper in debt. And then you remember a little later, there was something called the savings and loan bubble, and then crisis. And then bailout of billions of dollars. And this is where our current president really made his name, right? He had one of those failed savings and loan. And so we bailed him out for a couple of billion dollars. And nothing like free enterprise, I tell you, just nothing like free enterprise. Followed by the dot-com bubble and crisis and the invention of new debt instruments, especially derivatives. Any of you understand how derivatives work? They are debts on top of debts on top of debts that you bet on. And some of the bettors, they definitely have made a lot of money, but they have also totally obfuscated the way the system works. And more recently, we have the bottomless debt-funded money pit of the war on terror and the so-called but misnamed subprime mortgage crisis still unfolding. And we are in the process now of desperately trying to find some new debt instrument that will allow us to keep the system going through a series of bubbles, crises, and debt, bubbles, crises, debt, bubbles, crises, and debt. Until when? How long can we do this? So far, so good, said the man who jumped off the Empire State Building. So far, so good. But the system could collapse today, tomorrow, next year, 10 years, never? I don't think so. I think at some point, someone's going to have to pay. At some point, the Bank of Korea or the bank of someone's going to say, I don't trust the U.S. to pay off anymore. I think I want my money back. And whoever does it first, everyone else is going to follow. Now, no one wants to do it. Those countries are totally dependent upon us, especially China, who's got the best gig of all. They loan us money so we can buy their products. How can you beat that? No wonder they had, that opening ceremony of the Olympics was the most spectacular event I think I've ever seen in my life. I don't usually like big spectacular events, but that, the history of China in only 2 hours with casts of thousands. And not one, I believe, not one single event of communism. No mention of communism whatsoever. It never happened. No Mao, no Red Guards, nothing. pretty incredible. Anyway, that was fantastic. So, but China doesn't want the system to end. It wants to keep going because all of us are dependent upon it. So that's the unholy trinity. Peak oil, climate change, economic collapse, and they're all interrelated. We can't solve one by making the others worse. And that's often what we do. We say, oh, we'll solve the energy problem by nuclear, by coal, by all sorts of horrible things. That'll simply make the environmental issue worse. We can't solve climate change and related issues by throwing money at it because we don't have enough money to throw at it. And now we don't have enough credit. Folks are really careful about what they're willing to give us more money for because we haven't used it very wisely. For some, yes, but generally, no. So the only thing we have left to throw at any of these things is a lot of hard work. Okay, that's the Holy Trinity. What's the plus one? Well, many of us say, but can't the government help? And so when the economy tanked, can't the government give us money? I'm sure that $250 you got was very welcome, and did I just hear that if you didn't get it, you can fill out a form and get it? Well, yeah, $250 is better than nothing, but where did it come from? It came from the future. It came by putting the government even further in debt. It is not a way to solve the problem, and it's simply a Band-Aid, a way to act as though we're doing something. So basically, the government can't help anymore by deficit spending in order to fund new energy and environmental research and to prevent economic collapse, in my view. And the government can't do it even if it wanted to, which it doesn't, even if the most warm-hearted Democrats on the face of the earth win the election and sweep Congress, they're going to get there, which isn't going to happen. When they get there, they're going to discover they can't solve the problem, that government, American government, is now on its knees, if not flat on its face. We've had 20 years of bad-mouthing government. The neocons have made it a disgrace to work for the government. And so if you do work for the government, you don't want your children and neighbors to know. You pretend you're actually an entrepreneur doing something worthwhile. Through actual downsizing, taking people out of everything except military and quasi-military activities, privatizing, taking functions away from the government and giving it to the private sector to make lots of money off of, and outsourcing. I don't know whether this happened at the federal level. I don't know whether it's happened in Hawaii yet, but I know there are some states that when you call a state toll-free number for help from your state representative, you get somebody in India. And so even government itself is being, government services are being outsourced. And why not? Who cares where they're performed? One of the reasons we might need a CONCON is because we don't need territorially based government anymore. There are certain things that need to be done locally, like I'd like my fires actually to be put out and not virtually to be put out. But most of the rest of what government does are things that couldn't be done anywhere in the world. So why have such a big physical base for governmental activity? So the outsourcing people are moving that direction. But all of these are nails in the coffin of government. But it kept up and they'd nail it down farther. So finally they said, we know how to keep government dead, and that's to indebt it, to put it so far in debt it can't possibly do anything anymore. So massive debt, ever-growing massive debt, is the final nail on the coffin of good government. In other words, the gigantic national debt was incurred on purpose. It was not an unexpected or unanticipated consequence of other activities. The intent was to destroy effective government and leave everything up to private and not public forces. What Naomi Klein, I hope you've read her most recent book, calls disaster capitalism, in which profiteers like Blackwater or Battelle or Halliburton come to the scene to solve any problems that we might have. And the result of this, and I'd don't have enough time to go into detail on it, but the result of this is that America has become an anomaly for itself, but it's become a sort of a model for other governments. There are some other governments around the world that, because they followed our example in so many ways, have gotten themselves somewhat in the same situation. But America has become a strong nation in a weak state. The symbols of American nationalism are still extremely strong. Americans want to be proud of America. You can wave the flag or put the flag in the background or have it wave in back of whatever ridiculous thing you're saying, and your heart swells with pride. You are a loyal American, and the Constitution, not our little state dinky thing, but the one that's in a bomb-proof shelter in Washington, that's a revered holy document that we dare not change, even though it's extremely obsolete and definitely needs a lot of change. So we still stress patriotism and pride, and yet the state, that is to say the government, can do nothing for us. So I've been for the last several years talking to folks in Washington, especially the military, about this problem. How much longer are Americans going to be loyal to a nation whose state can do nothing for them? I was talking about this before Katrina, but then when Katrina happened, it became, that's what he's talking about, that the government was simply unable as government to solve the problems in New Orleans. As you might have read, and even in today's paper, that major parts of New Orleans still are under military control, basically, because of the chaos that exists there otherwise. And it's the people I mentioned before, Blackwater, Battelle, and Halliburton, who are in there taking care of the middle class. That's why we haven't had a revolt yet. These are just poor black people. Who cares about them? The white people either move out or are able to pay for their own solutions. So I think that this is an untenable and unsustainable situation. So, conclusion. I think it's far too late to prevent the consequences of the unholy trinity, plus one. I think that we can only deal with these issues and look forward to being the best little backwater on the planet. I'm for it. Not my preferred future, but I think it's the best one out of the options available to it. And I suspect that many of the clients of the Kokua Council and other councils similar to yours are already living in what might be the future for many of us, most of us here in Hawaii. So I, like many others here like me in Hawaii, have absolutely nothing to teach you and your clients. Rather, we all must learn how to live more simply and more frugally from the land and its own resources. And that's what I'm here to do. So thank you very much for giving me a chance to share these ideas.
Okay, we have time for some questions.
Or rebuttals.
Or rebuttals, or whatever you might say.
Yes, ma'am.
I agree with you, but all of our agricultural land, pineapple and sugar, it's now subdivisions. We could grow our own food if we would. How can we change that?
Well, you've certainly put your finger right on one of the most important issues. At the very least, we ought to do whatever we can politically to see that what hasn't already been actually subdivided not be subdivided, that no new housing go up of the kind that takes agricultural land. That's certainly one thing that I think we ought to do. And fortunately, many of these houses are pretty shabbily built, so they're easy to get rid of when the time comes and we need to. One of the things that I think we all need to do, I certainly need to do, is learn how to be a farmer. My son, I have a son who's at the University of Hawaii now. He's an Asian studies major, loves Asia, wants to go over there and make lots of money. He's also an international economics minor, so he can make even more money. But because he's my son, and because his girlfriend happens to be who she is, her family happens to have a big farm on the Big Island. So during vacations and on some weekends, he goes over there and learns how to slop pig and spread manure and do the other things that farmers need to do, just in case. And of course, he's got to feed me, since I live in a high rise in Waikiki with about this much space to grow my food in, and I've come accustomed to more food than that. So I really think that keeping land agriculture and encouraging the many people who want to farm to do so, and encourage the rest of us to learn how
That's
to do
very
it as well.
Political, because my
certainly
son
is.
Was an ag science major from UH. He's had a hard time being a farmer.
He says that her son is an ag science major and has a hard time being a farmer. Absolutely right. But I think, again, this is where policies made here can help. There'll be tremendous propaganda against it. I welcome people that object to my analysis. I think that it would be good for you to bring in people, if there are among you, who disagreed with what I said and give the other point of view. I don't want to be right. It's just that looking at it as carefully as I can, that's the conclusion I've come to. Yes.
I have a question. As backwater, the chances of us actually doing any of this, at least in the experience, I was not raised here, but I have a few years here, it seems to me one thing we're really good at doing is neglect. Our roads, they talk about potholes, the schools have this huge backlog. Are we going to take care of our agricultural land? I don't think so. How come we have all the sunlight, we have water? What is it, 22 million gallons of rainfall whenever it rains in Manoa, and it all drips off the roof and goes down into the ground? Don't you save any of it to flush the toilets? So we're not putting in any alternative energy, which we should have lots of by now. We don't fix anything. We don't inspect the dams till they break. If there's going to be a train, I just want to take bets from people about how long it'll be before the rails rust. You know, I think I'll make a fortune running a pool like that. How can we break out of being a backwater?
Well, that's not the part of the backwater I was talking about, but I was talking about the back part of being the backwater back when we were the backwater, and we did take care of things because we had to take care of things. There was no one else on whom we could rely. And since many of us are perhaps newcomers, and can always imagine we could go somewhere else, and a lot of us people here wish we would, there might very well be a tremendous exflux of people once the shit actually begins to hit the fan. We either will have to learn how to take care of ourselves, to be conservation-minded, resource-conserving, live off the land far more than we do now, or we'll die. And, of course, this is a metaphor for spaceship Earth, most obviously, that if we can do it here, and I think we'll have to do it here, it should give hope for the rest of the planet as well. I am a high-tech guy. I am not a farmer. I don't want to live this way. I just am confessing my failure of 40 years of living in Hawaii to get people to see the effects of what was coming and beginning to do something about it. Yes, sir.
Jim, do you see any evidence that the Hawaiian Electric Company is serious in its efforts to find sustainable ways to power the state?
That, again, is a very good question. And I would first of all say, at one level, there is no such thing as Hawaiian Electric. There are people, some of whom are decision-making officers, other people are middle managers, other people are line workers, and I know from talking to many of them, they have very different points of view. I have heard, I have no idea whether this is accurate, that the folks at the top haven't gotten the word yet. but that there is a younger generation, not that young, but younger generation of managers who are aware of these issues and are trying to push HECO into a more sustainable development. They still, from what I've heard about them, have sort of heroic assumptions about what, say, OTEC will do or some of the other things that are we've pioneered with for 30 years and should have in a developable state by this. So I'm not sure, again, that we have the time to do it, even if HECO were to move in the direction that some of its folks want to. So I would continue to ask questions like this of them, and especially of their board and top leaders. Yes, ma'am. Well, again, as I said, this isn't a world that I prefer. It's a world that I have, that many people that I have contested with over the years, people like Ira Roeder, people like Jan Houston, people like Tony Hodges, and many others who over the past made arguments that I'm now making. I said, no. We need to have a global world. We need to have a high-tech world. We need to all learn from each other. We ought not to be isolated. Well, they were right and I was wrong, is basically all I can say. Now, being self-sufficient doesn't mean being totally isolated from the rest of the world. There still are technologies that will allow us to go back and forth. Sailing ships are still viable. I used to be pretty good at paddling a canoe. Don't go to San Francisco. Molokai was far enough. But there are these technologies that we're able to do. Plus, from my point of view, I'd do whatever I could to keep the satellites up there, so a kind of a space program, so that we could have global communication. And one of the major things we need to do, again, something we've been talking about for 20 or 30 years, is examining the balance, the ratio between what we go to do and what we could telecommute to do. And I think we need to do more and more and more telecommunicating and less physically going. And again, that requires a willingness to go that route and then time and attention to begin to make the changes necessary. Certainly my own role as a teacher has changed dramatically as a result of the internet, just the way I teach face-to-face classes, as my students all know, the best way to get my attention is to send me an email. Don't show up at my office because I'm probably not there and you take too much bandwidth when I look at you face-to-face. But if you send me an email, I have it. I can think about it. I can send a reply back. It's there for both of us in case we wonder what I actually said. And so I find it a more efficient and I spend more time with my students online than I do face to face. It's changed my behavior. I used to be a personable guy. Now I'm not anymore, right? Other questions? I would very much appreciate those of you who disagree with me to please let me know. I've got to learn if I'm wrong. But if I'm right, I want some action on your part. Oh, okay, here we go. What do you have in mind? He said that we have, I've got to repeat it for the record. He said we have all the cost-effective energy sources now. Is that your term, cost-effective? What do you have in mind?
Base load can be, and it uses an engine that has been tested in geothermal wells around the world.
I should have given you the microphone to, because I'm not going to repeat those things, but Larry, I'll let you decide how to deal with that. My response would be I don't think there's any doubt that that's right in the long run. The question is how much time and literally energy will it take to get all those things operating? Do you think they are already operating? You said cost effective. Are they already operating now? Just a question of hooking stuff together?
They could all be carried about with fossil
fuels. Yeah, that's one of the problems. And I don't know whether you work for them or work as an advisor to them. But again, the answer that I gave you comes from talking to various folks, and who you talk to depends on what the answers are. I hope you're right, sir. I very much hope you're right. But don't count on it. Better hope I'm right. Because you don't lose anything in my case. But if we put all our eggs in the hope that HECO's going to provide us energy for fuel, for the fire, for local things, well, I hope they're right, but I don't think so. Okay, thank you all very, very, very much.